For the Medical Journal of Australia, I'm Kate Swanell. Welcome to the MJA podcast.
We've been fed a misconception that this is somehow a milder virus. It's a milder virus than Delta, but Delta several times more virulent than Wuhan. Do we really want Wuhan running riot? No.
Over the past 2 years, Dr. Norman Swan has become one of the most trusted medical voices in the country. His health report on the ABC has been essential listening for a long time, but his CoronaCast podcast has been the go-to source for the latest data about COVID-19 throughout the pandemic. Norman's book, So You Think You Know What's Good For You, took a well-aimed shot at the wellness industry, as well as being an entertaining read. Norman has been good enough to talk with me today about the book and the past 2 years of COVID life. My reading of the book is that you don't think much of the wellness industry. Would that be fair?
Yeah, completely fair. I mean, the reason I wrote the book was I'm sick to death of health books on the shelf.
Yes.
I'm absolutely sick of them. And I suspect most doctors are too. And I call out certain words. One is wellness. So let's just go to the health books industry. Most health books wag their finger at the reader. You know, they just say, you know, you have been a complete fool all your life. And if only you'd eaten goji berries, your life would be transformed. And to paraphrase H.L. Mencken, the American humorist in the early 20th century, and I'm grossly paraphrasing it, for every complicated problem, there's a clear and simple solution, which is always wrong. And that's the nature of health books. And they also preach, a lot of them preach wellness. And I'm sick to death. I don't mind well-being as a word, but wellness is just bullshit, because it actually, they just promote the idea that we're somehow entitled every morning to bounce out of bed with boundless energy, admire if you're a bloke, you know, your washboard abdomen, and if you're a woman, your shiny white teeth and thin thighs, and you've got this endless energy for the rest of the day, and this is somehow your birthright. And my argument is, how the bloody hell do you know that you're well or you've got this wellness if you feel it every day? You haven't got a clue, because that's just what you feel every day. The only reason we feel well and know what wellness is or well-being is that some days, in fact, many days, you feel utterly crap. You feel lousy. You know, you don't want to be at, you know, you don't want to be at work, and you go over and you wash your teeth and, you know, look at your, in my case, your Pinot Noir abdomen rather than your six pack. And that's the norm. I mean, and the other thing is that, and this is more of a criticism of my colleagues in medicine, is that we're very good at medicalizing things and giving them labels. So is the alternative medicine industry as well, the complementary medicine. Love giving things labels and making people feel that things are abnormal when they're not. This notion that you've got to be well all the time. Well, equally, it's not normal to feel crap all the time and to not want to get out of bed or wake up early in the morning and you've lost interest in your friends and things that we're doing. In that case, you've got an issue and you've got to deal with it. And you've got to know where that line is in the sand. You know, and I call out sleep. There's this notion that we all have to have 7 or 8 hours sleep a night. And if we're not, we're destined to get dementia. This epidemic of insomnia, because we're worried about insomnia. And every second person's got a bottle of water on their desk. Unfortunately, they've been told by somebody that they've got to drink liters a day. So Kate, for the listener, is holding up her bottle of water.
Yeah.
But, you know, we do have something called thirst. Ethiopian high mountain runners, the marathon runners, run best when they're 2% dehydrated. 2% dehydrated. Wow. And this business of having to drink at every drink station was got rid of by most coaches many years ago because it slowed the people down. In fact, could have made them sick from water intoxication. You know, there's all this stuff. You just got to, it's got to be sensible. And the other thing is that most health books take away agency from the individual, the ability to make decisions about yourself. And they tell you what to do. And what I want to do is just sort of lay it out in a broad sense and also from a socioeconomic perspective too, to give you that broad societal view as well as the microscopic.
Where do you think lifestyle medicine fits into that?
Well, it's very trendy. Look, it's part of the answer. Some of the fundamental, I grew up in a city, Glasgow, where the life expectancy gap between the sort of suburb I grew up in and the poorest suburb was, and I didn't come in a wealthy family, but I was lucky enough to grow up in a nice suburb, was between 11 and 13 years. The life expectancy gap between the longest lived suburb postcode in Australia and the shortest lived postcode is actually 43 years. 43 years. Lifestyle medicine is not going to get you to close that gap.
No.
That gap is about dispossession. It's about not acknowledging ownership. It's about not acknowledging culture. It's about no cultural safety. It's about loss of control. It's about chronic stress. All things that materially affect our well-being as much as getting out and getting some exercise and eating a healthy diet. You cannot do that unless you have agency. And if you are chronically stressed by your environment and dispossession and other things, then that has an effect on your body. And this is somehow mysterious to doctors and patients that the mind and the body are one. You know, when you die, your mind goes too. The brain is part of your body. And we pull in the external environment, we process it, and it influences how our body works. And how our body works influences our brain. This is not magical stuff. No. And we forget about that at our leisure.
So it's been quite the couple of years. You're arguably the most trusted, calm doctor in the country. Do you ever get angry about what's going on with COVID?
I get frustrated. I get frustrated by the fact that if you've read a textbook of public health, you know what's going to happen next. This pandemic has worked like pandemics have, for thousands of years. There's nothing new about it. People used to say to me in 2020 when it all began, how do you know what's going to happen? You seem to know what's going to happen next. I read the book.
Yes.
And you know, and also taking advice from experts who actually know what they're talking about. Yeah. And unfortunately, a lot of the federal government's experts didn't really know what they're talking about. Very clever people, nice people, very good on infection control in hospitals if you've got methicillin-resistant staff going, but not necessarily the right people to guide the government in terms of infection control and pandemics. And they're still they're very reluctant to accept aerosol spread, for example, which is quite clearly the case. And we've got this de-emphasis on ventilation as one of the solutions. So this is, and mask wearing and things like that. And people like me have been called miasma theorists and fantasists and doomsday predictors. There's nothing exceptional about Australia. It all comes to pass. And we're seeing it, unfortunately, as you and I are talking in early mid-January, we've seen it come to pass. This is what would have happened in 2020 with the Wuhan virus, which, by the way, is less virulent than Omicron. And we would have seen tens of thousands of deaths at that point because of there was no vaccination. Yeah. We would have been just like Britain, just like Northern Italy. And now we're seeing it, and we're lucky we're vaccinated to be able to show that. And we've been fed a misconception that this is somehow a milder virus. It's a milder virus than Delta, but Delta several times was more virulent than Wuhan. Do we really want Wuhan running riot? No. So I get frustrated rather than angry, very frustrated rather than angry, but I've got to actually hold that in check and just call it as it is.
Do you think the political colour of the governments is influencing things? Will things get better if governments change? Or do you think this is a symptomatic of humans?
The Lowy Institute did an analysis of this, and the colour of the government doesn't actually matter that much to the outcomes. It's just the willingness of a government to actually take on public health measures. Authoritarian governments can do badly, can do well. Conservative governments can do badly, can do well. There's no magic to this. The secret is accepting evidence rather than ideology.
I'm chatting today with Dr. Norman Swan from the ABC's Health Report and CoronaCast. His book, So You Think You Know What's Good For You, is available from Hatchet Books and all good bookstores. Links to Norman's ABC shows can be found in the show notes to this podcast. If you're enjoying this episode, you can catch up with our archived shows at mja.com.au/podcasts. And you can subscribe to upcoming episodes through Spotify, Apple Music, Amazon and Audible. Just search for Medical Journal of Australia and click subscribe. Back to our chat. I talk a lot to GPs. They have a Facebook group that I'm sure you've heard of, GPs Down Under. And they're having a discussion at the moment about whether or not they should declare what's going on now a disaster. Because if it's officially declared a disaster, there will be a whole series of changes to resources made available and the way they treat people. Instead of trying to treat everybody exceptionally, they treat who they can as well as they can. Do you think there's merit in that?
I'm just going to move sideways from that question a little bit and I'll come back to it, is that we've changed policy as a nation and we've changed it fairly quickly in the last, Again, we're talking in mid-January in the last 6 weeks. That's how quickly things happen. So in 2020, the initial tendency of the federal government was to not impose lockdowns, but the states pushed them into that. And the rhetoric and policy then was to flatten the curve. Then it became clear that you could, by flattening the curve, get down to zero spread. So the states were pushing that, and the federal government was pulled into zero spread reluctantly, but they moved ahead with that. And economies were able to open up. Now, with vaccination and the predictions of the Doherty model, which have been distorted by politicians.
Yes.
So the Doherty model predicted with Delta, not with Omicron, but with previous variants of the virus, they predicted that you couldn't control this with vaccination alone. You had to have test, trace, isolate, and quarantine. You couldn't let the case numbers go too high. You needed public health and social measures like masks in place. And occasionally you might need the occasional lockdown, but you would hope not. And the politicians, particularly New South Wales, have ignored that. So when they got to a certain level of vaccination, it was open up, mm-hmm. irrespective of the fact that you now had an even more contagious variant there. Now, the new metric for policy, although we've not said what the numbers are, so zero spread is easy. Zero spread. Yeah. That's a very easy metric. So what's the number of hospitalizations that you're prepared to accept? So there's some notion there, well, it's the capacity of the system, and when the system starts to go overload, that's when we will put in increasing measures to slow this down. But nobody uses the D word, which is deaths, and people are dying. And as we speak in New South Wales, to the middle of January, we've had a third of the deaths that we had in the whole of last year.
Yeah.
So 600 odd deaths last year, well over 200 now. And there'll be more, and there'll be more in Victoria. We've got exponential growth of hospitalizations in New South Wales and Victoria, and it seems in the ACT, with no sign of it turning around. Today, maybe there's a little bit of sign of that, but really no immediate sign that that's turning around, nor would you expect it to, because cases are probably only peaking round about in the next couple of weeks. They will peak, because vast numbers of people have been infected. So coming back to your original question, is it a disaster? Depends on who you're talking to. So if you've had a loved one die,
it's a disaster.
It doesn't feel good. If you've had a loved one who died largely because they couldn't have a booster before they had a booster, you're going to feel that it's a disaster, particularly when since August, it's been clear that you needed to have an escalated and serious booster campaign, even for Delta. And we didn't. We had a lack of, they became available, but that's all that was said to people by and large up until Omicron appeared was, it's there for you. We encourage you to get it, but not a strong campaign or anything like that.
Yeah.
And then when Omicron came along, they were caught flat-footed. In August, even earlier than August, with the extended lockdowns in New South Wales and Victoria, it became clear that with rapid antigen testing, you could actually open up sooner, particularly in key industries. And we knew that rapid antigen testing had to be part of the future. We didn't actually order rapid antigens in the sort of numbers we needed to take that into account. And that's, again, with advice and pressure from the pathology industry, who were worried that their PCR testing golden calf was going to be turned to ashes. These are policy fears. Now, do you call it a national disaster? I would be more measured, but I think that it's almost too late, because we've got the number of cases. They're probably going to peak anyway, and they're going to lead to hospitalizations, and probably that's inevitable. We can't do very much about that now. The question is, what do we do about the next variant? Because people are writing and saying, well, and some politicians are saying, this is it. So many people are going to be infected with Omicron. This is all over, Red Rover, and it's going to go endemic. The virus is probably already endemic in the sense that it's everywhere. But endemic, everybody listening to us knows that endemic does not mean harmless. Smallpox was endemic, malaria is endemic, influenza is endemic, it's not harmless. It doesn't mean herd immunity. And some people believe you won't get proper endemicity because this is an epidemic virus. And also, Omicron does not lead to the next variant. The next variant will pop up in a low-income country, independent of all the other variants, with its own features. And the features will be increased immune evasion. Actually, it could come from Australia or another advanced country, because we've got lots of virus circulating here and lots of immune compromised people. So you could actually get the next variant from here, like the British variant, the Alpha variant. It will definitely be more immune evasive and it could be more virulent. This is the other sense, is that it becomes less virulent as time goes on. There's zero evidence for that. It's a misconception. It could be more virulent, less virulent, or just the same.
So we need to be looking at getting low-income countries vaccinated, don't we?
It was 70% immunized by the middle of the year, and we're a long way off that.
Oh, yeah.
And this virus has got to be slowed down. Yeah. That's when we can start to relax and think that we're near the end. Yeah. And it hasn't slowed down yet. You just need to look at the numbers in Australia to know that it hasn't slowed down.
Do you have hopes or fears for the long-term effects on our healthcare system of what's happening now? I mean, workforce issues, salaries, elective surgeries, missed screenings, cancer treatments, aged care. What are your hopes going forward, and what are you worried about?
I don't see many signs that we've learned any lesson or significant lessons. In schools in Victoria, they're talking about ventilation, and but in other jurisdictions, you don't hear, some of them you do, some of them you don't. I'm not sure how much really this change in terms of ventilation in hospitals and attention to that, and an understanding of that. New South Wales, their advisors are still skeptical about aerosol spread. It's extraordinary. Mask wearing, you get the feeling that there's a reluctance even about mask wearing. With general practice, I think that general practice has done it tough. I think that the move to telehealth is a dangerous move. Video consultations may well make it easier. Hard to turn this back. John Emery, Professor of General Practice, Cancer and General Practice at the University of Melbourne, believes that part of the blame for late cancer diagnosis is at the door of phone telehealth, where doctors aren't seeing their patients. GPs know this. They don't particularly like telehealth.
No, they don't.
They know this. They don't get paid very well for it. And they're not seeing the patient. And when a good GP sees a patient, you've got a 15-minute consultation, the last couple of minutes, they're having a look at the patient and saying, oh, you're looking a bit peaky, are you okay? And said, well, no, funny enough, I've had a lot of bloating and blah, blah, blah. And said, well, I just need to do a few tests on you. That conversation's not happening. Before Omicron came along, you'd say, well, we're probably getting more sensible about who needs to be in hospital and who doesn't. Well, we're not seeing that with Omicron. We're seeing people turning up with an ambulance wanting a PCR test.
Plenty of people have said, oh, look, everybody's going to get it. You'll be fine. You're vaccinated. It'll be fine. I'm triple vaxxed and I absolutely am doing everything I can to avoid getting it. Am I wasting my time?
I honestly don't know the answer to that question. I mean, the natural infection probably gives you an extra boost to your immunity, which is not a bad thing, but you're also taking a risk. And some people are getting sick with three doses, but not very many of them. You really are well protected. I'm reasonably relaxed. I'm triple vaccinated. I got myself a Moderna booster, and I feel good about that, and feel, for at least for the time being, I'm pretty well protected, but I'm not sort of jumping into the mosh pit.
Do you think we have any chance of getting out of this cycle of variants and outbreaks in the next year?
Yes, if we immunize low-income countries and we're alert and we've got good genomic surveillance. So at the moment, genomic surveillance is a bit random internationally. That's the other thing that we haven't necessarily learned, is multilateral cooperation, global genomic surveillance, surveillance by veterinarians of potential zoonotic diseases. The next pandemic could be sitting there brewing from a bat to a human already, or in a pig farm or a chicken farm somewhere in Asia. The next pandemic could be soon. And we don't have the international cooperation and surveillance we need.
Wave a magic wand for me, Norman. What would you do tomorrow if you had all the money in the world and all the power in the world?
Well, I'd be going into sub-Saharan Africa and other countries that have got very low immunization rates, finding out what's needed in terms of person power, supplies of vaccine, logistics to actually get needles into arms. And that would be my highest priority to do that. And I would set up a rigorous international network of genomic surveillance, which includes veterinarians, so that you're ready for the next one. So established infrastructures around the world, which will survive this pandemic and help us control this one. Eventually we will get it under control, but we need to do it fast. And the other thing is that I would remind people that there is a benefit to regulation. So what we're seeing now in Australia, as we're talking in mid-January, is economic devastation.
Yep.
And the reason for the economic devastation is this notion of personal responsibility. So this was promulgated in early December by the New South Wales government and by the federal government as well. That's what's happening. Young people with personal responsibility are saying, well, we're off to party. We're okay. We're vaccinated. No problem. And older people who feel more at risk are not spending money. They're not doing anything because they don't know where the boundaries are. So it's not an even playing field. But if you have public health regulations, I'm not saying lockdown, but you've got sensible public health regulations, about spacing, what sort of businesses can be open, what sort of businesses can't. We could have saved this economic devastation. We didn't have this during lockdown. Businesses knew what was what. Yeah. Now it's random because some people are choosing to stay at home.
Thanks, Norman. I really appreciate it.
Nice to talk to you.
My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.